Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media doesn't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time, but now we're going after The Deep State. I want to bring on Brandon Weikert. Brandon is the host of NatSec Talk podcast. Brandon, welcome. Good to have you. I want to ask about foreign policy more broadly, too, Brandon. I mentioned a minute ago, I happened to be in Dubai a couple of months ago. I was in Kuwait several weeks before that. And there was a lot of uncertainty as to the direction of American foreign policy, especially as it relates to Iran and the Persian Gulf. And then we attacked Iran. I went back to Dubai, and the complaints I heard there were actually very direct and very logical. Yeah. The complaints were, Kuwait has something like 15,000 U.S. ground troops. Bahrain is the headquarters of the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. Qatar hosts Al Udeid Air Base, which is the largest air base in the world. The Emirates host another, 10, 15,000 American ground troops. And with all those assets, we could not protect those countries when the Iranians began to launch drones. And so the leaderships are wondering, what's in it for them? Why would they host American military assets if the assets can't protect them? What would you tell them? What would you tell these leaders?
Well, I have told some of the Saudis that I know that personally, if I were sitting in the Arab states, I would say, please don't come back. Yeah. I would say, we'll do business, happily do business with you. But, and frankly, from my perspective, that actually, there's silver lining here. I mean, yes, it would be humiliating for our country in the short run, as the withdrawal from Afghanistan was, but ultimately, tag, you're it. And ultimately, it's not our problem anymore. Yeah. And think about how much resources that frees up and how much headache would go away virtually overnight if we simply were not allowed to reclaim those bases. That would be the ultimate silver lining for the U.S. defense posture, because these are signs of imperial overreach for the United States. And if you're sitting in the Arab states, we've just painted giant red targets on them. And as you said, we couldn't provide defense. It's worse than that. We couldn't, because our defense industrial base, despite almost now $1.5 trillion in budgeting they're going to be getting, they can't produce enough defensive weapons to protect these facilities. We were having to pick where we were going to send, we're robbing Peter to pay Paul, basically, pulling it out of UCOM, pulling it out of Indo-PACOM, pulling it out of, wherever, and sending it to Israel. We weren't even really defending our own air bases. And I think also the Arab states are saying, wait a second, you're not even going to protect your own people. You're going to protect the third party. What does that benefit us? And now look at what's happened to those Arab states. They've had their economies crushed. People don't realize the Arab states, for the most part, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, these Arab states, these are not the Arab states of 30 years ago, 20 years ago. These Arab states were becoming economic dynamos.
Oh, yes.
And a lot of opportunity out there. I've had offers to go out, to Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of opportunity for entrepreneurs from all over the world in these countries. And that is at risk now. And in the case of Bahrain, in the case of Qatar, they're going to have to be doing a lot of rebuilding. And if you're Bahrain, by the way, you're a majority Shiite country. You're sitting there going, what the hell? Why did we do any of this? The Iranians are our countrymen, co-religionists, I should say. I would actually welcome us not being invited back, if I can be honest, because I think we did more harm than good. And I think we can redirect those resources away from the sandbox and maybe put them into our own hemisphere. Mm-hmm. There's a lot we could do here to shore up our own defenses. The border, for instance. I know nobody likes to talk about this, but, I want to secure the border. That's something that we could be spending much more resources on doing than poking around the Middle East and starting all these wars that never end well for us.
No,
ever.
They never do. I've saved a little bit of time for us at the end to talk about artificial intelligence. This is something that I really struggle with. I mean, I use it just about every day, and it's a lot of fun, and it's incredible. Yeah. Sometimes it's wrong. Most of the time, it's right. But a question that I get a lot that I am unable to answer is, how would a CIA officer operating in 2026 evade AI to cross borders, to carry out an intelligence operation, to essentially fly under the radar? Is it even possible in the age of AI to do something and not be detected, like crossing a border?
Yeah, it depends on what country you're trying to penetrate, I would think. I think that this is one of the reasons why we don't really have a great human intelligence set in China. You can't break into China anymore. I mean, not really.
No.
It's very difficult. Certain countries, yes, you could still use those conventional forms of spycraft, I would think, but metadata collection and, you know, the grid, if you will, not to sound all Tron here, but the grid is, it's pretty ubiquitous these days. And interestingly, it's actually not China that's building it out to the level that you would think. It's actually the United States. It's actually the Europeans who are really committed to this kind of, you know, big brother. You know, I mean, of course, China has a social credit system within their country, but we're talking about spreading our surveillance state globally. And obviously there's reasons, you know, for the intelligence community that wants to do that. But I'm not sure it's good for anybody, any average citizen anywhere, to have the U.S. I'm probably going to get in trouble for saying this, but to have the U.S. intelligence, you know, apparatus all seeing Gorgon stare, you know, wherever in the world. In terms of penetration, I would think that many traditional forms of spycraft are going to go by the wayside. We're going to have to create entirely new methods because it will be increasingly difficult. I think about the border and I'm like, look at all the millions of people that slipped in. I mean, you know, maybe actually it still will be easy, but I can't imagine it would be.
Yeah.
Not really a good answer. I apologize.
I have to agree with you. This is still a no man's land. We just don't know the answers to these questions because the questions haven't been around long enough for us to formulate answers.
The only limiting factor would be energy. What energy is available? What water is available to sustain the data centers that really power AI? And if these companies start really getting into nuclear power, yes, it would benefit average energy consumers by offering alternatives, but that would ensure that the surveillance state would be truly all-seeing and basically uninterruptible.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about economic strength. You've argued that economic strength underpins military power. What domestic policies do you think are the most important for sustaining long-term American competitiveness?
Well, this is very interesting because I occasionally consult with the Department of the Air Force, and I remember I was at the Capitol Hill Club giving a briefing to about a dozen of these generals, and one of the generals came up to me, and he was very disturbed because I talked about the tech sector in China and sort of what's going on there with STEM education and whatnot. And, you know, he said that he was assigned to Google, which I thought was interesting. I said, okay. And he said, there's all these kids at Google are brilliant, but they all hate America. And I laughed and I said, part of the problem is the educational system in the United States. I go, not only are we churning out kids that are statistically dumber than their predecessors and previous generations, I said, but we're also turning out kids who have been indoctrinated on some level to not like the country that they're living in. And I said, I would say that the greatest strategic threat to the United States is our educational program or lack thereof. It's not China or Russia. It's our ability to cultivate and propagate human capital. China has a very impressive human capital base. Russia, actually, I know people make fun of the Russians. They have this sort of 1990s view of Russia. But the Russians have always had a very, very healthy human capital base, at least among the top level of their people, very educated scientists, you know, innovators and whatnot. And so I would say that one of the ways that we sustain our competitiveness long term is we're going to have to figure out how to teach our kids reading, writing, and math.
Yes.
Again, we've got to go back to the basics, you know, and what we're doing is not working. And when I left government, I did a few years as a teacher. I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself, and I was a high school teacher, social studies. And I saw firsthand, I always tell people, I was on the front lines of that battle, and I quit for a reason. It was mortifying, and I was at a relatively good school. Our kids are not being taught well. The system does not encourage teachers to teach well. It doesn't hire the best always teacher. You have to really have a passion for it. You know, you go to some of these Asian countries and teachers there are making like $200,000 a year, the equivalent of that. Come to the United States, they're not making that. You know, so you're not attracting the talent and you're not prioritizing the young people in the United States. You're prioritizing the gerontocracy. You know, we're paying out more to old people every year than we do to our young people. And then we wonder why the country's burning all around us.
How bad do you think that gets? This declining public trust, declining trust in our institutions, how bad of an impact is this going to be on national cohesion?
Oh, I think it's critical in crisis levels. I mean, I think that it will be a miracle if we can avoid some kind of civil, I don't want to say civil war, but some kind of civil disruption. Wow. We are, I think, rapidly heading toward that, regardless of what happens. And by the way, if this thing in the Middle East really gets bad with the disruptions, that could expedite the breakdown, right? Because,
agreed.
You know, people are going to be fighting for resources at home.
Yeah.
It's going to get ugly fast. And I think at this point, the only thing we can do is push through it. I don't think we can avoid it. It might not be as bad, but I think that we are really heading toward there's a reason that Xi Jinping right now is very confident around President Trump.
Yeah.
I think it's because he has assessed, and I think Putin has assessed this, although I don't think Putin is as excited of this as is Xi, that the Americans are definitely in decline, and you know, we're going to be going through some really nasty stuff over the next decade that probably will, it will break the country down for a period of time at least.
I'm
that happy note.
I know, right? I hate to agree.
Dr. Doom again, strikes again.
But I have to agree. Listen, all my life I've been accused of being overly optimistic about things, about life in general. And I'm trying really hard to be optimistic about this, but I have to agree with you. I think we are headed towards some sort of civil
crisis.
Unrest. Yeah. Civil crisis is the best way to say it.
Yeah.
Some sort of civil crisis. I don't know exactly what it'll be about, but I'll add that I was in Ireland recently, a few weeks ago, and
they're not doing well.
And they experienced the biggest demonstrations in the history of Ireland over gas prices. You know, we complain here, like, I actually refused to get gas day before yesterday because I refused to pay $4.59 a gallon. I won't do it on principle.
It's like five something here.
And it's $9 plus a gallon in Ireland. And the Irish make about 2/3 of what the average American makes. You just can't do it.
No. Well, and then they also have these issues with the demographics, right? I mean, they've had immigration issues. It's funny because I'm good friends with an author named Michael Walsh, and he lives in Ireland and, you know, hates the British. But he's now openly advocating. Yeah, he's openly advocating that let bygones be bygones. Native-born Irishmen need to befriend native-born British and form an alliance that basically stops the unwanted flow of refugees and migration into to Ireland and Britain, because it is having deleterious impacts on the stability and the social cohesion of those countries. And so basically it has to be a stand of the Anglosphere against their own governments. I mean, this is the part that people don't seem to really understand, is it's our own governments who are making really bad policy decisions, and I'm still trying to figure out if it's intentional or if it's just incompetence or bad ideology, maybe some combination thereof. But, you know, we entered the 21st century, the Anglosphere, the American English-speaking countries, entered as undisputed champions of, you know, the Cold War, the World Wars. I mean, we came out of the 20th century looking like, you know, we were
Supermen.
And then in 26 years, it's all gone away. And it's now people are seriously thinking about China is the new future. And actually, if you look at the amount of world leaders that Xi in the last 6 to 8 weeks has entertained in Beijing, including many of our allies, they're looking to Beijing as a stabilizing force, not to Washington. This is a very, very, very irreparable, I think, situation for the West. And now we just got to try to, you know, save what we can, you know, to last a little longer. But I don't think the idea of dominance, I think that needs to get out of people's heads, because we can't dominate anything. We can't even dominate our own border, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Let me ask you about
that. I don't know if that answered your question
I'm sorry. It does. You and I are of like mind on this. The United States, it's no secret that the United States has a military budget that exceeds that of the next 9 largest countries combined.
Yeah.
It's bankrupting us. And in the meantime, we have terrible roads and terrible airports and terrible bridges that are falling into the rivers below them, terrible ports, ships crashing into those bridges that we saw in
Baltimore.
Never to be rebuilt.
Yeah.
Is it even possible to transition from this gigantic military budget to a budget focused on physical plant and infrastructure and transportation, or are we past the point of no return?
I think it's going, and I've been accused lately by people who used to be friends of mine in D.C. of rooting for the enemy. So I'm not. So I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this without being seen as. But basically, I think it's probably going to require a strategic defeat of the United States military for Congress to wake up and for our leaders to wake up and say how we've been doing it since 1991 is not working.
It's not working.
And I wish that there was another way. I have for 10 years been trying to get the government to change its evil ways in the defense sector. That, you know, it goes in one ear and out the other. Everybody smiles and nods, and then, it, you know, they go about their day collecting their paycheck. So, you know, until the system is shocked, and I think it would require something like a strategic defeat. It would have to be a big enough one, though, because we had a strategic defeat in Afghanistan, and nobody batted an eye. We just went into Ukraine.
It's true.
You know, we're having a strategic defeat in Ukraine. Really, we are.
Yes.
And nobody cares. We're getting our asses kicked in the Middle East, and nobody seems to care.
Yes.
So I don't know what it's going to... That's the only thing, though, I can think of is a strategic defeat on some level, or the loss of an aircraft carrier in combat,
right,
which I think we came very close to a handful of times in the last year. But something significant to shock people and to say, hey, we can't do this anymore. And by the way, we're going to be spending $1.5 trillion. What is it actually getting us? I mean, we're losing everywhere we go. So I don't want to say my hope, but something like that shocking, because having a politician campaign on this is not enough. It's because they don't change anything once they get into power. I mean, you know this with the intelligence community, right? I mean, there's a lot of reforms the IC needs, but they keep being given all the money. They keep being given all the,
virtually an unlimited budget. Yes.
Virtually an unlimited budget. I mean, John Brennan is not at CIA, but a lot of his people still are. And
yes, they are.
It's like, you know, so, I mean, unless there's like a real gutting of the defense and intelligence apparatus with personnel and with projects, we're never going to make that change.
Right.
One of the things I do get heartened by, though, is we have to make the argument that industrial policy, education policy, even trade policy, these are national security policies as well. So maybe there's a way we could convince people to focus on those domestic kind of policies by making it about it's a security thing too.
And it
ultimately is. Though it is. It is. But ultimately though, you know, as long as the Defense Department is sucking up that much money, you know, we're gonna be stuck in this rut. And I think actually another answer, and I don't know if you would agree with this or not, but I think federalism, subsidiarity, where we let the states have more control over their futures, I think that actually might ameliorate some of the breakdown, the violent breakdown that I fear is coming. If you let the localities and the states have more control, California does its thing, Florida does its thing, you know, that might, it'll cause problems. But, you know, that is the Constitution at its core, was what it was supposed to be about, is the regions and the states and the local cities, they all kind of have some degree of autonomy because we're such a big country. You let them experiment. That, to me, might be one way also out of the civil crisis that I fear is coming.
Yeah. You and I are in complete agreement over these
awesome.
These strategic mistakes that have been made. I was at the CIA in those days where we were talking about the peace dividend, and it was all over. We won. Mm-hmm. We're the unipower in the world. And then things just kind of went down the toilet after 9/11.
It would have worked. It actually, I argue, 9/11 was the spark, but actually you could see the breakdown by 1993.
Yeah.
You could see the breakdown by Black Hawk Down. You could see the breakdown in logic.
Good point.
Going back to Serbia and Kosovo, right? Because the theory in international relations, not to get too theoretical here, but I am a nerd. The theory was R2P, responsibility to protect. Well, the Cold War was over, and the failing of the Cold War was we had too many cold-hearted realists. Now that there's no Soviet enemy, we're the unipolar power. We can dictate human rights and democracy and morality.
Yes.
And that is actually what triggered, I think, a lot of our problems. It set us up for 9/11. Brilliantly, in a way, because a lot of the Muslim world was looking at us going, we don't want transgender rights or whatever, you know, we don't want whatever you're selling, you know. And so this, I think, on some level helped to create the fertile ground for the revolutionary Islamic, you know, side of things.
I think that's right.
Been downhill since then.
You see, you've anticipated my next question. My next question was, what strategic mistakes do you think the United States made after the Cold War that sort of led to the current position? But that's it right there. And I have
to
agree.
It's imperial. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the empire. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. You know, there are certain things that we can have dominance in. Like I've always said, we should be the top dog in like space. That's something that we need. We use space more than any other country. So by definition, I think we should have a greater role up there. But, you know, in terms of do I care about running Nigeria or Timbuktu, or, you know, you pick some small, like, why are we obsessing over that? Why do I care as an American? Actually, why should I care what happens in the internal dynamics of Iran? Why should I care about the river in Lebanon that they're fighting over right now, the Litani River? Why should I, as an American living in Florida, why do I care about the Litani River rights? Like, that's just like, this is not even be on my radar. But this is, you know, so there are things that we don't need to worry about that we're being made to worry about that's creating this feedback loop that feeds the deep state, feeds the war machine, and justifies imperial overstretch. Of course, they don't see it as imperial overstretch, but that's what it is. It's breaking our force structure. We can't address real strategic concerns now, like China.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I have to ask you about NATO. The president of Cyprus made a statement 2 or 3 weeks ago in which he said that the European Union is compelled to come up with a NATO-like defense structure because NATO can't be relied on. And listen, I travel a lot just like you travel a lot, and I've been getting the same hypothetical question lately that is fascinating to me, and it doesn't really have an answer. The Israeli defense minister has said publicly that Israel's next big fight is going to be with Turkey. Mm-hmm. And the Turks say, bring it on, right? It's one of the biggest militaries in NATO. They hate the Israelis. Yeah. They're ready for a fight. Okay, well, this is not so simple. If the Israelis do attack Turkey, a very big if, and Turkey invokes Article 5 of the United Nations, of the the NATO Charter.
Yeah,
the United States and every other NATO country would be compelled to fight Israel on behalf of Turkey. The Greeks are just delighting in this, as are the Cypriots.
I bet they are.
But it's a real question.
I've gotten it myself.
To me, it would be the end of NATO because there's no possible way the United States ever would defend Turkey against Israel. Diplomatically, sure, they send a Philip Habib type person to do shuttle diplomacy and, you know, they try to get everybody to back down. But how do you see something like that playing out?
Well, I actually think, just remove the Americans from the equation for a second, I actually don't think Europe would defend Turkey.
I mean, I don't either.
There, There was a chance in 2002, and this is a great missed opportunity, I think, on the part of the Europeans. There was a chance. Turkey wanted to be fully integrated into the EU, and they're already in NATO, but they wanted to be fully integrated into the European society. It's a lot very similar to what happened with Russia in the 90s and 2000s.
Sure.
They wanted to be part of that European system,
mm-hmm.
and the Europeans went, we'll get around to it. And we all know the reason that the Europeans didn't want them in there. It was cultural. It was mm-hmm. historical. Okay. Well,
and they already occupy another European Union country.
That's true. Yeah. Yes. So the Europeans are sitting there going, we don't. And then of course there's the issue with the Greeks as well. So ultimately the Europeans said, no thanks, but keep sending your people up to be used as laborers and whatnot. But ultimately that set Turkey down this course of I don't want to say Islamic extremism, but you know, they decidedly turned away from the Western bearing that they were on under Ataturk, and then embraced Erdogan's vision of a more unique society in Southern Europe that was different and yet equal, if not superior, militarily to Europe. I don't believe NATO would ever defend Turkey, and to be fair, I don't think Israel will actually attack Turkey.
Nor do I.
People don't understand behind the scenes, despite the rhetoric, Erdogan and Netanyahu are business partners in many respects with these pipelines. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that with the help of the U.S. at times, Israel, Turkey, the U.S., some of the Arab states were supporting these jihadi groups, for instance, in Syria. Which was part of a wider scheme to create these new pipelines, natural gas and oil pipelines, that would benefit Turkey, benefit Israel, benefit certain Arab states. And that's a whole nother story. In fact, right now, though, you are seeing Turkey and Israel and the U.S. cooperating on creating the Zanger Corridor in Central Asia with Azerbaijan, where we are basically letting everybody slaughter the Christians so that we can build this pipeline that will take Central Asian energy through northern Iraq into Syria, now controlled by head-chopping Jilani, and then pump it up into parts of Israel and into Turkey, where Turkey will then disseminate it to Europe and they can charge transit fees and whatnot. So, you know, I don't actually believe the rivalry between Turkey and Israel is actually true. I think that's a lot for show. And I think that if Israel did really want to take on Turkey, I think Turkey is enough of a military power on its own that would be a very ill-advised move by Israel. Israel can't defeat Hezbollah right now. You know, the Merkava massacres are going on
right now.
So this is... You know, ultimately, though, the question of NATO in general, I think the United States should have bailed out of NATO at the end of the Cold War and should have relied on the OSCE as a framework for security that would have allowed Russia to take part in it, and it would have stabilized, and it would have created basically a security cordon involving Russia that would have gone from basically Los Angeles mm-hmm. through Europe all the way to Vladivostok.
Thank you very much for being with us today. That was Brandon Weikert. And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. And remember to always ask the questions the government doesn't want you asking. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.